Questioning Paul, Chapter 12, Part 3.
Shaul's modus operandi was to justify his elusive sayings through terse references to the word. His mocking interpretations were arrogantly spoken. His arguments were simplistic and contrived, resulting in the most popular counterfeit ever foisted against humanity, one bolstered by his always-present cliques. He even claimed to bear offspring, experiencing birth pangs to deliver the descendants of his faith. In this regard, Shaul was fixated on misapplying the connotations and significance of the Hebrew word for offspring, Zerah, claiming that it gave rise to his faith. And as is the case with most deceivers, Paulus made pledges and demanded that believers hold them and him in the highest esteem. He even claimed that he was the co-savior, completing the sacrifice and message. Shaul dismissed and demeaned all those who would dare question him. He claimed that by challenging him, a person was actually demonstrating their animosity toward God, and that by implication, such a person was serving Satan. Although the opposite is true, most Christians fall for this ad hominem ploy, dismissing evidenced arguments against their religion and its author by claiming that the critic is hell-bent. Believers routinely commit the logical fallacies of ad hominem, non sequitur, red herring, and straw man. Using the ad hominem fallacy, they readily discard a valid proposition by demeaning the one who pronounced it. For example, the overwhelming preponderance of Muslims were unable to refute anything in Prophet of Dune, so they dismissed the best documented, most comprehensive, contextual, and chronological presentation of Muhammad's words and deeds by profane attacks on my character. 1,000 pages of evidence were thereby discarded with a flippant, "The author is a jerk." With the non sequitur approach, the faithful make general statements which are widely accepted, but such statements, regardless of their veracity, do not support their premise. It is this disassociation that makes such an argument fallacious. An example of this would be, "Since God's word is eternal, that proves that my Bible is inerrant." With the red herring fallacy, rather than deal with the evidence brought against their religion, believers try to distract people's attention from it. For example, rather than deal with Paul's admission that he was insane, a person deploying this fallacy will say something like, "You can't tell me that I don't have a relationship with Jesus or that Christ isn't my Savior." And finally, as the straw man fallacy implies, rather than attempt to refute the case which has actually been presented, the apologist will errantly convey their opponent's argument and then attack their artificial construct. Someone deploying this fallacy would disprove the creation account by criticizing religious interpretations of it rather than address the actual Hebrew text Yahweh inspired. The reason religious belief systems like Christianity are adverse to evidence and reason, and the questions these tools raise, is because those who seek the truth lose their faith. Neither facts nor logic matter in matters of religion. The believer's pledge, even in a vacuum, is considered sufficient and binding. Before we press on, here is a summary of where we have just been. Of Shaul, Yahweh revealed,
"Upon my requirements and responsibilities, I have decided I will literally and continually stand, and I will choose to always stand and present myself upon that which protects and fortifies. So then I will be on the lookout in order to see what he will say about me, observing how he will question me. But then, how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response concerning my disapproving rebuke?" 2 verse 1, "Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, and he said, write this revelation and then expound upon and reiterate it using letters upon writing tablets so that by reciting this, he might run and go away. 2 verse 2, still indeed, this revelation from God is for thee of the mode appointed meeting times. It provides a witness and speaks, pouring out evidence in the end which entrants the extended period of time required for this question to be resolved shall not prove it false. Expect him in this regard, because indeed, he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. 2 verse 3, pay attention, He will be puffed up with false pride. His soul, it is not right nor straightforward in him. So then through trust and reliance, by being firmly established and upheld by that which is dependable and truthful, those who are righteous and vindicated live. 2 verse 4, moreover, because the intoxicating wine and inebriating spirit of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal is a high-minded moral failure, and is arrogant with meritless presumptions, he will not rest, find peace, nor live. Whoever is open to the broad path, the duplicitous and improper way, associated with Sheol, he and his soul are like the plague of death. And so those who are brought together by him, accepting him, will never be satisfied. Most every Gentile will gather together unto him, all of the people from different races and nations. 2 verse 5, they do not ask questions, any of them, about him. Terse references to the word they lift up as taunts to ridicule, along with elusive sayings, simplistic and contrived equivalences, and mocking interpretations, controlling through comparison, counterfeit and cliches, along with derisive words arrogantly conveyed. There are odd and perplexing questions which need to be asked of him, and double dealings to be known regarding him. And so they should say, woe to the one who claims to be great so as to increase his offspring, acting like a rabbi, when neither apply to him. For how long will they make pledges based upon his significance, becoming burdened by his testimony? Habakkuk 2 verse 6.
This next statement is associated with the previous prediction. It is rendered from the Dead Sea Scrolls because the Qumran text differs considerably from the Masoretic.
And he loads himself down with thick mud, so why not quickly, for a short period of time, rise up and take a stand? And those of you who are bitten and are making payments to him, wake up from your stupor moving away in fear of him, because you will be considered plunder, victimized by them. Habakkuk 2 verse 7.
God is saying that the only thing caved, weighty and significant, about Sheol is that he has covered himself and others in muck. Methinks Yah was poking fun at Sheol's murky and messy prose. But clearly, God does not want us to remain in the mud with him, which is why he is asking us to get off of our knees and take a stand. So we cannot say that we were not warned or advised. God even told us how to respond to this horrible individual. He wants us to stand up against all forms of corruption. Political, religious, military, and economic. We are to confront lies and liars. Paul routinely solicits money from believers. It is one of many reasons Christian clerics embrace him. Following his example, Christian institutions have made merchandise of men. So he is trying to rouse his victims before it is too late.
Because you have plundered, stealing the possessions of an enormous number of Gentiles, so they shall loot and victimize all of the remaining nations by means of the blood of humankind and also through the violent and cruel destructive forces terrorizing the land and Yah's city, even all of those living in her. Habakkuk 2 verse 8.
Paul mercilessly attacks Jews throughout his letters, making them the enemy of his new religion, thereby creating the anti-Semitism that ultimately took root in the Christian church. Paul, a Roman citizen, seeded the hatred of God's chosen people that boiled over 70 years later with the destruction of Israel and Jerusalem by the Emperor's legions. It happened just as Yahweh predicted it would. 684 years from the time this prophecy was committed to writing, Jerusalem was sacked and the temple was destroyed. 63 years later, Israel was salted, and those not murdered by Rome were hauled off into slavery. According to Yahweh, to be cut off from him is to be estranged from the covenant, thereby excluded from this relationship, and forsaken, which is to be damned. Therefore, you do not want God to say of you what he said of Sheol.
Woe to one who is cut off, coveting, while wickedly soliciting ill-gotten gain in relation to him setting his house and temple in association with heights of heaven so as to spare the acquired property and possessions from the paws of fellow countrymen. Habakkuk 2 verse 9.
The Roman Catholic Church, which was founded on Pauline doctrine, not only constructs gold-laden cathedrals and has storehouses filled with tens of billions of dollars of ill-gotten gain, they have positioned themselves as having sole possession of the keys to heaven. It is interesting, however, that recently they have had to return more than $1 billion to the families of children their priests have molested, priests following the Pauline mandate not to marry. Yahweh's next line is a succinct, unambiguous, and damning summation of Galatians and the consequence of Pauline Christianity. God's verdict regarding this man is irrefutable.
You have deliberately decided upon and conspired at the advice of another to promote a shameful plot to confuse those who approach your house, ruining and reducing by cutting off many people from different races and places and in the process losing your soul. Habakkuk 2 verse 10.
This answers a question I'm often asked. Did Paul deliberately perpetrate this fraud or was he misled? It also affirms the now obvious connection between Shaul and Satan, the very spirit he acknowledged had possessed and goaded him. Recognizing that Beth, family and home, serves as the basis for the Bereth, family-oriented covenant relationship, with this second reference to home, family, and household, God is inferring that Shaul's new covenant is a shameful plot designed to confuse the unwary, leading them away from his covenant. And remember, Paul referred to himself as the mother of the faithful, and thus of his new covenant family. He even wrote about life in the household he had conceived. To be cut off from Yahweh's covenant, the covenant Shaul condemned in Galatians, is to die with one's soul ceasing to exist. So while the soul of the perpetrator of this crime will be lost forever in Sheol, the souls of his victims are reduced to nothing, their lives squandered as a result of Shaul's shameful scheme. Since God has a lot more to say about Shaul, while I'd like to move on to other tests and prophetic statements, let's linger here a while longer and see if Yah has anything more to say that might be of value regarding his perceptions of this man and his message. And what we find in the next verse is another reference to the rock, to the disciple Yahusha, prepared, established, and named to publicly question and confront Shaul.
Indeed, the rock is part of the structure of a home, will issue a proclamation, and that which connects from the timber, he will answer and respond. Habakkuk 2 verse 11.
And while we know that Shimon Kephas, the man Yahusha, personally named the rock, summoned Shaul to Jerusalem and issued a proclamation against him, there are some other, less obvious, symbols in the verse. And foremost among them is that Shimon acquired the moniker rock, when Yahusha, in Hebrew, told Shimon,
"Upon this rock, I will build my invitations to be called out and meet."
Banda speaks of building and re-establishing a home for the family, and thus is quite similar to Kair and Kafik, which represent the physical sum and substance of the home, its flesh, the walls, ceiling, plaster, rafters, and beams. Throwing the rock at the man who in Gnostic fashion hated the flesh, by referencing the building materials associated with the home, is Yahweh's way of rewarding and enlightening those who are observant. Similarly, Yahweh associates Yahusha with its timber, to reveal how he, as the Passover lamb and the upright pillar of the tabernacle, provides eternal life for his family by way of the upright wooden pillars of Passover's doorway. And that is why Yahweh uses Ena, to answer and respond, in this context. It is the operative word of the Micrae, where Yahweh asks us Ena, to answer and respond, to his invitations to be called out and meet, because they provide the lone means to salvation.
Woe to the one who re-establishes the place of exposed naked flesh and anguish in blood, and he forms a populated institution promoting that which is unrighteous, invalid, and harmful. Habakkuk 2 verse 12.
It's interesting that immediately after using Bana to make a point relative to the previous verse, we find it in this one. Great minds think alike. Not mine, mind you, but here we find Yahusha and Yahweh communicating the same message by juxtaposing rock and build. And here Bana is being deployed to warn readers against participating in his Bana, rebuilt and reconstructed, family of faith. In most English Bibles, you will find both Iyer and Kyria rendered city, as if they were translating the repetition of the same word. But considering Yahweh's prowess for effective communication, when we find different words being deployed to convey a similar idea, examining the etymology is always productive, as it is here. In that error is from Ur, we discover that it addresses the blindness so many have to the flesh being naked and exposed, or how they can be incited, so that they suffer anguish and perpetrate terror. And in that Kyria is a derivative of Kara and Kyria, in this word's history, we encounter the foundation and furnishings of a popular institution where many people congregate as a result of and to listen to preaching. These are loaded terms with Pauline implications. Blood is of the flesh. A minuscule amount is shed during circumcision, but it is poured out in great abundance by the Passover lamb. While no connection may be intended, from the pronunciation perspective, Ur, the name of the Babylonian city that Yahweh asked Abraham to Yatza, come out of, in Casdim, Chaldea, so that he could lahalak, walk toward, God in the promised land, sounds similar to Iyer, in that it is actually based upon Ur. Shaul's testimony is Allah, invalid and harmful, perverse and damaging, unjust and evil, leading to unrighteousness. And while that was Paul's intent, it is Yahweh's to Howie, warn us, about him. There is a much better choice.
Why not look here and pay attention by means of an association with Yahweh of conscripts who provide assistance? But instead, the people expend their energy and grow weary amongst an abundance of worthlessness, and the nations which gather together in more than enough delusions and fantasies which are poured forth which are unreal and have no benefit, resulting in nothingness exhausting and destroying them. Habakkuk 2 verse 13.
Here, Am can mean people, family, or nation, and almost always speaks of Israel. LAOWM addresses large populations which gather or congregate together, who seldom have an affinity with the Promised Land. The former, representing Shaul and rabbinical Judaism, obeying their Talmud, toil for nothing. The latter, representing Paulus and Christianity, believing the myths, delusions and fantasies this man has extolled are destroyed by them. As an interesting aside, Aish, the word translated worthlessness, also speaks of lightning, addressing the worthless flashing light Shaul claimed to see in the sky which became part of his conversion experience. It also means fire, especially in the sense of that which combusts and consumes. In this role Aish serves as a metaphor for judgment. And once again, there is a better, more satisfying and fulfilling choice.
Indeed, she will fulfill, edify, and completely satisfy the land to approach, to actually know, and to become genuinely familiar with Yahweh's manifestation of power, glorious presence, and abundant value, similar to the rain providing a covering for the sea. Habakkuk 2 verse 14.
She refers to the maternal manifestation of God's light, the Isha, better known as the Ruach Kodesh, set apart spirit. Our spiritual mother makes us appear perfect before God by adorning us in her garment of light. She not only plays the leading role in fulfilling most of the microi, she enriches and empowers the covenant's children, imparting an abundance of valuable information. She not only equips us to better know Yah, she makes it possible for us to enter his presence. When we consider what has preceded this statement, it is hard to miss the fact that Paul's spirit weakens and destroys while Yah's spirit enlightens and edifies. Paul's spirit poisons while Yah's spirit heals. And that is because Yahweh's promises are all fulfilled by his spirit during the microi, while Shaul's promises are all as vain and worthless as the spirit which possessed him. Eretz, land, and Kaka, to cover, are initially brought together in the story of the flood, where Yahweh washes away the initial and vicious scum of religion and politics so as to give humankind the opportunity to get to know Him, to approach Him, and to be with Him, to Layada, Eth Yahweh. Moreover, the Kappa, covering, in the sense of the garment of light adorning the covenant's children, Mame, waters, representing the source of life and cleaning, and Kabod, the manifestation of power and glorious presence of Yahweh, are all references to the set-apart Spirit of God. Also, by condemning the destructive mythology of Shaul in verse 13 to the completely satisfying presence of our spiritual mother in verse 14, we find Yahweh doing what I have attempted to do throughout questioning Paul, comparing the empty myths of man to the glorious and satisfying nature of God. We considered this next statement way back in chapter 3. It not only warns us about Shaul's profuse venom and his perverted sexuality, it addresses Paul's little and lowly reputation, in addition to his animosity toward circumcision. So from Shaul's unquestioning hint to Paulus and his lowly and little moniker, from poisonous toxins to an unacceptable approach to the sign of the covenant, this is an indicting summation of this man's legacy.
Woe to the one who causes and allows his companions and countrymen to drink, thereby associating them with this antagonizing venom upon you, but also intoxicating for the purpose of looking at their genitals. Habakkuk 2 verse 15, you will get your fill of shame and infamy, a little and lowly status instead of honor and glory. Choosing to intoxicate, in addition, you also elect to show them an acceptable, going roundabout over their choice not to become circumcised, upon you as the binding cup of Yahweh's right hand. Therefore, public humiliation and a lowly status will be your reward. Habakkuk 2 verse 16.
Pauline doctrine is an intoxicating poison, venom from the most vile of serpents. But more indicting still, Shaul, who never knew the love of a woman, provocatively expressed his love for a young man, Timothy. And even though Paul detested circumcision, and spoke hatefully about the sign and requirement of the covenant, he personally circumcised his love interest. Furthermore, Shaul so craved recognition and status, he heaped it upon himself. But here God is saying that Shaul's poisonous and inebriating attack against the decision to be circumcised will come full circle and engulf him in shame. The man who claimed to be God's exclusive apostle to the Gentiles has become the man of infamy. Paulus, little and lowly. I dare say, in the whole of Yahweh's prophetic testimony, no prediction is as dire as this one. But that is because no one ever did what Paul has done. It was not required of anyone else. If nothing else, Yahweh has provided his evaluation of Paul and his assessment of his followers. In this light, the only way to view him and his religion favorably would be to ignore God and estrange ourselves from him. The debate is over. The choice is black and white. If we are to be true to this prophetic warning, we should question everything Paul says and writes. And we should hold him accountable. It may be too little, but it is never too late. Continuing to intertwine encouragement into the midst of this overwhelming condemnation of Shaul and his demonic associate, Yahweh reaffirms his promise.
Indeed, from this grievous injustice against and blatant wrongdoing in opposition to that which purifies, empowers, and enriches, he will constantly keep you covered and continually protected, and as for the destructive demonic beasts, he will shatter them. Habakkuk 2 verse 17.
I was personally stunned that Shaul actually and unequivocally admitted to being demon-possessed, because back when I was a Christian, we constantly speculated on what the thorn in my side represented, oblivious to the fact that he answered the question not once, but twice. But even when I first came to be troubled by the conflicts between Paul and God, I never thought that Yahweh was this frank with us. And yet 666 years before the most blatantly errant and hideously destructive man in human history perpetrated his great crime against humanity, Yahweh referred to him and his wayward spirit as demonic beasts. While Paul and Satan have had their run, and their way with humankind, their dominion is about to come to a crashing end. Babylon and the beast will soon be shattered. their power will wane. And when that happens, when the unrighteous campaign against the Torah is snuffed out, those who remain under God's constant protection will stand tall, not unlike the once towering cedars of Anon. Those standing beside Yahweh upon his return will have four things in common. 1. We will have come to know and love Yahweh. 2. We will have accepted the conditions of the covenant. 3. We will have answered Yahweh's invitations to be called out and meet. 4. And we will have arrived at this place and time because we devoted the time to observe his Torah and prophets. The rewards are priceless, but they do not come without a significant investment of time. This verse is a classic example. J-Mod could have been superficially defined as violence against, instead of this grievous injustice against and blatant wrongdoing in opposition to. The former, however, requires us to ignore the fact that nouns are defined by their verbal forms. And here the verb chamak communicates injustice and wrongdoing in opposition to oppress, and unrighteousness based upon an unethical and false witness which is laid bare against the standard. Labanon could have been transliterated Anon, instead of being defined by its component parts. And as we now know, Laban is defined as purifying, cleansing, and widening. Anon speaks of being substantially empowered, growing vigorously, all while becoming substantially enriched. Therefore, the translation of Labanon as that which purifies, empowers, and enriches, is more relevant and edifying than a simple transliteration. Kaka could have been flippantly rendered "he conceals and hides you," but, instead, he will constantly keep you covered and continually protected, enables us to incorporate the implications of the plural stem and imperfect conjugation. And it is considerably more consistent with how Kaka is deployed throughout the Torah and Prophets. Shed was written as a construct noun, which means that it is forever bound to Behma, the beasts, in a sentence. That means that the beasts possess the attributes associated with Shed. These could have been inadequately translated the havoc-making and destructive nature of, instead of the destructive demonic. But by choosing the former, we'd have to ignore the fact that prior to the Masoretic diacritical marks the Hebrew word written Shindale was equally comfortable being rendered breast, demon and devil, or destructive havoc. While bosom can be disregarded in this context, there is no valid justification for selecting demonic over destructive. Therefore, when trying to communicate the whole truth, the only responsible and sensible approach is to include both definitions, especially since they work in harmony to define the nature of the beasts. Speaking of the Behma, the plural form could have been conveyed as wild animals, rather than beasts. However, in light of Yahusha's integration of the devil, the beast, the false prophet, and the whore of Babylon in the revelation to Yahalchanan, any other rendering would have been irresponsible. Also, Chakath could have been translated "he will frighten and dismay them," instead of "he will shatter them." However, since the primary definition of the word provides a perfect foreshadowing of what we are told will be the ultimate fate of Satan, his beast and false prophet, in addition to his religious, political, economic and militaristic system known as the Whore of Babylon, why not render the word accordingly? So in every case I took the time to consider every aspect of each word, consistently examining the roots. And as a result, the renderings I selected are every bit as justifiable, if not substantially preferable, to those typically found in popular Bible translations. The only difference is that I was careful and strove to methodically examine every word under an etymological microscope, while striving to provide a rendering that was not only as correct and complete as is possible, but also the most fitting within this context of this discussion.
End of part 3.